Great. So I'm going to walk you through a bit about how the day is going to go, because remember, expect the unexpected and just follow along on the journey. So we're going to have five plenary sessions with people, with speakers and moderators here up at the front. So in terms of kind of the arc, think about it as setting the context in the morning. So we're going to be talking about what should good look like in this generation. Then we're going to switch to levers, shaping good. Then we're going to talk about how this all applies to the Sustainable Development Goals. And then we're going to talk about movements and building momentum. And then in between, we have long breaks. So general, that's the general plan for today. I think next slide. There we go. So a few things on the interaction. So you already know about Brain Date, so that's good. If you have any more questions, go to the Brain Date Lounge. We also want to hear from you. We won't have a Q&A in the traditional sense, but we will be using a technology platform called Slido. So if I can get, if you have a phone on you, great. If you don't, that's probably the future, so congratulations. But if you have a phone on you, if you can just type in SLI.DO. So, and I won't show it on the slide, but once you're there, then enter the event code, hashtag FOG. And that way, you can enter all of your questions or your comments, and you can take a look at kind of what's going on in the minds of the participants. Make sense? And one thing I want to just try and get across is when you're thinking about questions, it's not necessarily questions for the speakers. And I think we have an amazing group of speakers, but I'm not expecting them to answer those questions all the time either. I think sometimes what we just need to do is put a good question out there and ponder it. And anybody can ponder it. It doesn't just have to be speakers. So please keep that in mind as you're using Slido. Oh, and Twitter is future of good. You can also use hashtag fog, but you might, especially if you're using like Instagram, you're just going to find pictures of fog. So maybe I tried that. I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. So with that, for the next, here we go. On to plenary one. There we go. So plenary one, what should good look like in this generation and why? So we have your moderator, Vinod Rajasekaran, who's the co-founder of Future of Good. And then we have two panels, and the first panel is on the future of legacy, which is fitting from our morning's discussion. So we have Jess Bolduc, who's the executive director of the 4Rs Youth Movement, a collaboration of 14 national organizations who are working with youth to create capacities for Indigenous and non-Indigenous young people to come together to cultivate understanding and action in support of a better future. So that's the first panelist. Sorry. The second panelist is Nick Breisowitz, who's the Director of Development of the Long Now Foundation, a nonprofit in San Francisco exploring new ways to foster long-term thinking in this framework of the next 10,000 years. So legacy and thinking way out into the future. After that, Vinod will bring on Indy Johar for the second panel to talk about ambition. So Indy Johar is an architect, co-founder of ZeroZero, and a senior innovation associate with the Young Foundation. He's also a co-founder of Dark Matter Laboratories, which aims to apply complex system science to value chain innovation, management, and relationships. So that's a little bit about who's going to be on the stage. And with that, I think I can invite Vinod up.
Okay. And Jess. it's just me.
I'm just waiting in the wings, wondering what I should do.
Right. Super.
Someone tell me what to do.
Yeah. How are you? How is breakfast?
I'm good. Breakfast is
good. I'm hearing an echo. Okay. Yeah. How was breakfast? Was that good?
It was good.
It was lovely, wasn't it? When you're in dense urban environments like this, is food grounding for you?
This is a dense urban environment. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like meet some basic needs. Everyone needs to eat, right? And so it's a great way to start the day. The more like familiar sometimes I think foods are, the more comforting foods are. It's like that helps people to sink into a certain kind of energy into whatever it is the day will bring. But for me, this is so early. So I just grabbed an apple and an orange, and I didn't get to taste any of the delicious treats there yet because I'm not ready. Okay. Maybe around 10 o'clock. Like, that's okay. Breakfast time for me.
Right, yeah. So sorry about the early start.
Oh, it's okay.
If it makes you feel better, my alarm didn't go off this morning. So, yeah.
We're both here, and that's what matters.
Yeah. Well, listen, let's... Is there still echo? Yeah, well, is everyone okay? Like, can we just get going? Yeah? Okay, all right. Well, as they're working on that, let's dive into it. Legacy, you know? Last night, this morning, set us up well for exploring this question. And if you, like, among lots of things, legacy is priced today. Like, for $30 million, like, you can have your name on a building. Like, in a university. The Baldock Building. Right? And you can buy education outcomes for tens of thousands of people. And, you know, in a way, good gets individualized. And you see this happened over many, many, many decades. And there's a certain pattern. People of a certain class and privilege. You walk down, you know, whether it's downtown Ottawa, downtown Toronto, wherever you are, and you see the names on the buildings. It's people of a certain class and privilege and background. And these folks have good attributed to them. Mm-hmm. So, like, take us back. Take us back to a place, take us back to a mindset, an outlook, before legacy was priced. Give us an Indigenous perspective on legacy.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Vinod. I think to begin, I'll sort of place and position myself in relation to these lands and this Algonquin territory. And I'm Anishinaabe. And the Algonquin people were cousins, were family, and there's a connection there. And I come from Bawatin, Sault Ste. Marie. And in my culture and in my community, legacy is something that is defined through community, and is defined through a different kind of time scale. And so it's not wealth in the way that we might know wealth now is not wealth in the way that we used to define it. And so I see legacy now tied really closely to a definition of wealth, which is about money. The Algonquin grandmother who did our opening here, I'm not sure if she's still here or not, but Miigwech for that, to remind us of she spoke about seven generations. So legacy is not only the generations to be thinking about the generations that have come before me, but also to the generations that will be coming after me. And so legacy, I think, is something that is this bridge between those two timescales. It goes beyond just material things. My sense of being a good person is not how much I individually can acquire. So whether that's positions of power or accolades or all of these material things, it's actually defined by what I can give to others. And I think that that's representative of the way that our communities used to be and the way in which our communities are trying to get back to. Is that there is nothing, there is no one was left without anything.
Right. So
this, why is this, you know, legacy and tied to wealth? Why is decoupling those two important for the future?
Legacy, decoupling the two.
Legacy.
Yeah, because we live in a world where, like, we talk about the 1%, right? And so if legacy is only tied to wealth, then it's about legacy is about accumulating something for oneself rather than distributing it to others. And so it needs to be, yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Vinod. Because it does.
Right. Okay. So let's pick up from what Monique said this morning, which is absolutely beautiful. In your mind, what does it mean to be a good ancestor?
Yeah. I think the first part of that is really to just acknowledge that I have ancestors. And I don't think that's something that we do enough. And we may think about our grandparents because they may be living with us. But do we think about, like, the path that all of the people who made us who we are was? And so by when I think about this generational thing, it's like, who was there seven generations behind me that helped me to become who I am today? And so that allows me to think about that I'm not separate from those people, that they are a part of me and they actually are helping to walk with me on this journey that I am right now. And so if I'm able to think about that as an Anishinaabe person, I'm also able to reflect on what has happened to my ancestors too as well, and to acknowledge the healing and the types of choices that I can make now in my present time that will make sure that those things are not the legacy of what the future might be for my nieces and nephews, or if I happen to have children one day. So there's like this point of transition that in the present I currently am.
Have we lost the capacity, that this reflective capacity, to look back seven generations? Have most of us lost it?
I think so. I mean, I've lost it. And I know that we say these words like seven generations and things, but it's like a very conscious effort to think about that, to really like spend time to think about who my ancestors were and how that shapes who I am today. And to go forward, I think it's the same kind of thing. Like, what does it mean to think in seven generations? And it requires a different kind of thinking about permanence, I think. So I had a conversation with a friend of mine recently, and he said he was in a job that was like a temporary thing, and he finally got a permanent position there. And he sat and he reflected, and he said all of a sudden every decision I made was different because there was a sense of permanence in that. And so if we think about not in what am I going to do today that's going to affect tomorrow, but what is the impact of what I do right now going to affect someone 50, 100 years from now? Like, how would that change the way that I would make a decision? And I think that because we live in such a society that's about like instant gratitude or gratification, that's the word, instant gratification. Like.
Hearts, likes, thumbs. Yeah.
Slido. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. that becomes like very, very difficult for people to even think long term in that way.
Right. That's great. So 50 years, 100 years, 10,000 years. So let's bring up Nick and let's add some perspectives. Thank you, Jess. Nick, as we just to get going, we spoke about the coupling of legacy and wealth, the reflective capacity to look back seven generations, as well as look ahead. What was something that stood out for you from what Jess said?
Well, when it comes to legacy on a 10,000-year time scale, I think a couple of things kind of wash out, and it's a really complex space that needs to be respected as a complex space and not oversimplified into good and bad. Because legacy is hard. You know, you mentioned like naming a building, and that's, you know, obviously coupled to wealth. But, you know, there's a couple of other legacy examples that have been coupled to wealth. About seven generations ago, in 1890, there was a guy named Eugene Scheiflin, who was committed to this idea of bringing all of the birds that were mentioned in all of Shakespeare's works into Central Park. He wanted to bring it. And back in, you know, the end of the 19th century, this was like an in vogue thing for elites to do. They would go travel.
So was this with birds or Shakespeare?
A little of both, right? A little of both, as you do. The elite class was obsessed with going to the other part of the world and bringing plants and animals to other parts of the world where they weren't native. And it was backed up by all the best science of the day, right? So people would do this. This is good for biodiversity. It's a good thing. You're doing a good. You're doing good with your money and your wealth, and you're going to leave a legacy. You're going to have all these birds that were named in Shakespeare here in Central Park. Well, it turns out he introduced the European starling. So he brought 60 European starlings into Central Park, and they're really good hunters, and they're an invasive species. And now there are 200 million European starlings in North America. And this is not a good legacy to have. Eugene Scheiflin did not go down, he did not get accolades for that. There's a lot of problems with that. So legacy is a tough one, right, on a 10,000-year time scale. The further you go out, the more it becomes unclear exactly what good looks like. And so when we plan and think about the next 10,000 years, we try to emphasize the moral imperative of preserving possibilities for the future, preserving optionality, and allowing these subsequent generations to have the elbow room and flexibility to decide for themselves what's needed in that moment. So not really having the hubris of saying that we know exactly what we should be doing or where we should be in 10,000 years, what that looks like.
So we know about invasive species a lot more now, right? So if we were to roll this back, what would options look like for this person?
For Eugene Scheiflin? So preserving optionality for us, you know, he thought he was doing it. He was giving us biodiversity. He's bringing other animal species here in North America that weren't here before. It seems like a really good idea. There's always these, like, secondary effects that we can't always be aware of that we should be on the alert for. And if we're on the alert for it, then, you know, we don't kind of stick our feet in the mud and think that we know what we should be doing. We know what, you know, good looks like. It's a really complex question. What is good? What's going to be good down the line?
So I'm obsessed with Long Now seminars. And if you haven't seen, there's podcasts, there's videos. They're absolutely amazing. From your perspective, why is it important that something like Long Now exists today?
Yeah. I think it's important to remind people to kind of pick their heads up from their phones and look out at a 10,000-year horizon. 10,000 years is about how long we've had civilization around. So it also sounds like it's how long the Algonquins have been here. So 10,000 years back, 10,000 years forward, that 20,000-year period of the Long Now, we think that's the appropriate place to put yourself in this narrative. It gives you a sense of agency. You know, if I told you to solve hunger, and I told you you had 5 years, you'd kind of be paralyzed. You wouldn't really know what to do. It would be tough to decide what is good. Or 12 years, 2030. So that's a really tough one. But if I told you it's 500 years, your agency is kind of bolstered, and you have this idea of at least knowing how to start. I know how to get going on a 500-year-long project, but who's doing 500?
So why do we do it? Why do we give ourselves 5 or 10 or 12 years?
I think there's necessity that plays in, right? It's a luxury to be able to think about the next 10,000 years, but it's also this interesting, you know, it's also a luxury to make any kind of sacrifice. Those of us that went to college or if we've worked on events like this and projects, like, there's a lot of late nights. I'm sure you've been up late planning for a future of good and stuff. So you kind of make these sacrifices in the present moment for gain on a longer time scale. And we want to preserve this idea that, okay, we're all hustling, we're all trying to do everything we can in the present moment to, you know, you open up Twitter and the world's going to hell. And so you're trying to figure out what to do in the present moment, but we want to preserve some fraction of your attention, some fraction of your resources for the next 10,000 years. It's not an all-or-nothing strategy. Sometimes people come in, they think, you know, over the Long Now, we're just these patient people who, you know, no, the rent is due on the first of every month, and you have to deal with things in the present moment. But kind of setting aside some time, some reflective time, some resources for the next 7 generations or 10,000 years is a good idea too.
Right. So I want to tell you something. I did something a few months ago where I took a taxi to go watch a film on climate change. This was in San Francisco. And have you heard of moral licensing?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a psychological blind spot where there's a subconscious phenomenon that allows us to give ourselves disproportionate credit while doing one good and kind of while ignoring consequences of another. So it's being good psychologically gives you the permission to be bad, right? So another example that's commonly quoted is you take the elevator to go to the gym. What are the long-term effects when 1 billion people do this at scale?
Yeah, we get back into the complexity of the moral space here in that I wish I had such a strong moral structure for the next 10,000 years that I could say that action A was good and it was permitting or giving someone license to do action B, which is bad. But I actually think the line differentiating good and bad on a 10,000-year time scale is a tough one. The closest we come to a hard line is preservation or elimination. So when the last speaker of a language dies, always towards preservation whenever we can, when the last speaker of a language dies, that worldview is gone. So we have a language preservation project, the Rosetta Project, with field workers all over the world collecting all documentation for all 7,000 languages and then finding unique ways to archive it for 10,000 years because we want to preserve these things. We also have a biodiversity, like a genomic technology project called Revive and Restore. You've heard about the folks bringing back the woolly mammoth or the passenger pigeon. That's these folks. And the idea is, like, preservation seems to be the best thing we can hope for is optionality. I think Stuart Brand said that the Long Now Foundation isn't about determining a destiny for its descendants. It's about allowing them to determine a destiny for themselves. So kind of preserving that. That's the closest we get to good. So, the moral licensing example in this context would kind of look like, well, did you preserve a bunch of languages, but then in the process, like, destroy a bunch of languages? It's kind of tough to think about how moral licensing would come into play for the next 10,000 years just because morality is so complex on that time scale and foggy.
Thank you for that. Just I want to bring you in to this because preserving optionality is fascinating stuff. And I want to go back to something that you said and that Monique said this morning. When we think of it, whatever it is, hunger, invasive species, gender equality, pick any one of the SDG domains or other things that we're working on. These are not single generation. These are not single generation issues. These are cross generational, and we need multiple generations working together, imagining together, creating together, and so on. But it still feels like to me it still feels like there's a lot of shame and blame across generations, and it doesn't feel like we've gotten good at passing the torch well. What does it mean to pass the torch well?
I mean, the thing that comes to mind with me is just, like, we need to spend more time with each other. And I think that one of the speakers who stood up here yesterday said something about, I'm an old now, or something like that, I think she said, or that she's in the older generation now. In order for us to be able to pass the torches, we actually just need to come to know one another again. It's like, how often does everyone in this room spend time with someone who's over the age of 70? Like, quality time, I wonder. I mean, maybe people might want to put their hands up or not, but, like, and not just one person. Like, not just your grandparent or a person that you're visiting. Like, immersing yourself with another generation and coming to know what it's like to to spend time with them. And similarly with younger people, I'm so grateful to have the school here too as well, because it's the same kind of thing. Because as much as we need to learn about how to work cross-culturally with each other, we also need to work about, need to see each other intergenerationally. And there are communities that do this well. But for some reason, we institutionalize our elders in society, and whereas in my culture, our elders are our knowledge keepers and work directly with the children. And so there's this constant intention to make sure that that knowledge is being cycled and passed through to the generations that are growing up. So it's always very circular. So
population.
Mm-hmm.
What does preserving optionality look like when we have an aging population? Like this institutionalization that you speak of. Is there an option for reverse institutionalization? And what's?
I hope so. I really do. But I think that, like, to me, I'm always like, so my grandfather was we call them old folks homes back at home. Anyway, in the old folks home. He was in the old folks home. It's an institution. And he said to me, he's like, it's being in a prison camp. And I used to think, my grandfather's passed away now, but I used to think, I wish that I could come and do interventions here. And I know that there's places overseas where actually university students are, their dorms are within old folks' homes now. And so it's just co-living. So there are examples of how you can be bringing generations together. And we're starting in the indigenous community and in pockets, we're starting to reclaim that idea of community education and community building by making sure that our elders are recentered in these conversations, that the children and the women are recentered in community. And through those types of acts of resurgence, we are creating those moments for preservation. The thing that scares me, though, is that who gets to control the preservation, like in thinking about your topic, right? And if it's the guy who wants to bring in the diversity into the park is the one who's controlling the preservation, that can be very problematic.
Nick?
Yeah.
What does it mean to pass the torch well?
Yeah. I think Jess nailed it. I think it's exactly bringing the generations together for conversation. And sometimes that works around like a dais like this where all eyes are focused on one person, and then you can kind of converse about whatever it is. So that's kind of where we got the we have a speaking series in San Francisco monthly called the Seminar Series, where we bring leading thinkers in to talk about their work in the context of the next 10,000 years. So whether it's a planetary astrobiologist or whether it's a systems engineer or a science fiction author, we kind of bring them in. And then, you know, our audience, it's kind of nice. I get to sit in the front and look back at everybody. And we've got everything from teenagers to, like, octogenarians in the audience. And, you know, Long Now's been around for 20 years now. The seminar series is about 10 years old. And so a lot of the audience is, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, which is really interesting. But then now we're seeing this wave of, like, teenagers come in. And it's really cool whenever I'm out in the lobby or we're at a reception afterwards. It's interesting because there's always this tension, right, of being like, oh, I'm an old now. There's this identifying thing where it's like this otherizing of oneself across generations. But then we can also do a good job of like bringing that together and finding like the common ground. So it's like, let's not focus on the distinctions between us and these generations. Let's kind of focus on the commonalities we have. And so kind of doing that, kind of bringing that around and converging around this speaking series has been really interesting. And yeah, every now and then I'll see a teenager, some 80-year-old guy, like having a conversation, a really lively conversation in the lobby or at a reception. It's just
right.
The coolest.
Right. Terrific. I want to get us into thinking about how do we choose to remember the good that happens today. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and in August sometime, we went for a walk in downtown Ottawa, and if you go for a walk in downtown Ottawa, you come across all these statues and monuments and all of that. And she's at this age where she kind of goes, what's that? And you tell her, what's this, right? So, and you kind of make your way, and then, you know, I got to the statue of Johnny MacDonald, who's Canada's first prime minister. And so she goes, who's that? That's Johnny MacDonald. Canada's first prime minister. And then I struggled. And this was at a time, if you remember, Jess, a lot surfaced about his role in architecting the residential school system. And there was stuff that surfaced around Robert E. Lee before that. And I struggled with it. And so when we think about the 10,000-year scale, preserving optionality, when we think about who gets to decide, right, whose names go on buildings and who gets a statue and who doesn't, like, how do you decide which parts of history get revisited and corrected?
I don't think you have to decide. I think each generation will decide to revisit history, as we're seeing in the States, as you're seeing up here. I think every generation, there is that optionality of saying, all right, is this something you want to preserve and teach your children about? Is this somebody you still want to deify and raise up as an example, you know, as a leader, as somebody you want to look up to, as, like, the moral rectitude you're trying to instill in the next generation? Or is this something that, you know, you can kind of let the sands of time blow over it, or recontextualize it as an example of infamy, you know? So I think each generation has the option. I think you have to revisit. Everybody has to revisit your history and reinterpret it for themselves. And so I think that's just a process that's inevitable, that people are going to look back at these things and rejudge and redecide. It's always going to be, you know, it's kind of like a history is written by the winners, right? History is always kind of open up for a reinterpretation. You can always look back at it and say, actually, it wasn't that way. It was this way. So I think that's a powerful optionality that's automatically built into each generation.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I will add that it requires a revolutionary or bold act in order for that to happen. I think about Indian residential schools, and it took some very brave survivors to finally speak out about what had happened to them in those schools. And this was a history that had been purposely made invisible to the Canadian public because it deeply ties. This is why wealth and legacy are a tricky thing, because Canada's values have been built on the founding of this country, but the founding of this country at its core essence was around economics and wealth and gaining that wealth and those resources, the natural resources, at no expense. And so what that meant was that it was upon the genocide of Indigenous peoples and on the backs of black slaves. That's how Canada was built. And so now we sort of claim these good values of Canada, but fundamentally there's a lot of toxicity that exists within there. So the idea of Canada being good, but the motive behind creating Canada was for economic gain and wealth. Anyway, I'm going off on all sorts of kinds of crazy tangents, but what I'm trying to say, I think, about, like, this conversation about what we're talking about, this generation things, is that it takes somebody to be brave, and it takes somebody else to listen and to believe that truth, because that's how you can shift those kinds of things.
Justin, thank you so much. This was hugely insightful. A round of applause for Justin. Thank you so much. Before I bring up Indy, we have a couple of minutes to get on Slido. Jane, yeah.
There's a switch in you from startups to systems. Mm-hmm. What changed in you? What did you realize?
Lots of things. I think number one was that I realized that the startup conversation was very small. It wasn't addressing what I think is the fundamental question. What was interesting about the conversation before for me was that I think the real crisis we face is how we define ourselves. And I think we've been living under a kind of 300 to 400 year illusion of the individual, an illusion of the individual, illusion of us as individuals, discrete human beings. Leonardo da Vinci's kind of drawing of the man standing there, I think that is an illusion. It's a very powerful conceptual framework that has underpinned a civilization model, which I think is coming to the end of its usefulness. And I think that definitiveness, I think, has allowed us to deal with what was a relatively an infinite world by siling everything up and seeing things as individual objects. Yet, actually, science no longer supports that worldview. So if you know anything about quantum physics, it says that's not how the world is. If you know anything about actually even your biology, it was eloquently spoken earlier, well, actually, we are a multitude of organisms that cohabit. Actually, if you know anything about our mentality, our personality, we're a confluence of personalities. If you know anything about epigenetics, well, it says we are highly interdependent with our context. So there's a kind of illusion that's been at the centerpiece of our thinking for nearly 300 to 400 years, a kind of a Newtonian enlightenment. Very powerful illusion, right? Really important. But it no longer is useful for the world that's coming about. And I think that, to me, is the centerpiece of the transition. And when you start to look at it from that sense, I think you have to start to see the world differently, and you have to conceptualize, and your language is different. So one of the big fundamental problems is our language is out of date now. We have an object-orientated language. We see things in objects. And that language is now holding us back to being able to innovate in the real world, in the world as we now know it to be. And that was really one of the big drivers.
And what about language?
Yeah.
Is holding us back?
Everything. I mean, so language, the color blue, right, theoretically never existed till the word blue was understood and socialized, right? Language constructs our social reality. It is how we see things, how things materialize in front of us. I think our language is now out of date. It's not able to see the world. There is no object. We are just fragments of a whole. We are segments of a whole. Now, that is exactly what physics and science is telling us already. But our language is all constructed about saying the Nord, right? It's all object. We're noun-orientated language. And I think that's fundamentally out of date with actually what the physics is telling us. So we don't have a grammar, a syntax, to be able to operate in this world. It was really interesting, even in the previous conversation, we were oscillating in this tension of the individual and the responsibility to the whole, whereas actually that may be the illusion. That may be still us looking from the individual outwards, whereas actually what if we are the whole, right? What if actually the issue is that we are misconceptualizing ourselves as individuals and then trying to be the whole, whereas actually there might be a completely different way of seeing, which is where I think when you start to look at it from that perspective, you can't look at things individually. You have to start to think about things from a system perspective or some other word, which I don't even know yet.
Right. So on that, you know,
yeah.
Ross Barrett, head of Village Capital,
yeah,
recently said, we can't create problems with 95% of our resources and expect 5% of our resources to solve them.
Yeah.
We spend billions finding the next professional athlete and almost nothing finding the next big leap in social services. What is he on about?
I think what he's on about is actually, well, it's pretty obvious what he's on about in the sense as you articulate it, which is that actually, yes, we're not investing into understanding. So, look, everything I talked about in terms of science is way ahead of how we understand social policy. How we understand social policy is still regressive, right? So, for example, if you, the impact of poverty is it takes 10 IQ points off individuals. It doesn't matter who you are, right? You put any of us in stressful situations, there goes our IQ, right? So we know these things, yet we're not able to invent and reinvent what social policy and social justice really looks like technically for a world which is about emancipating all of us and freeing all of us. And that is a distance. And so, yeah, we aren't investing because we don't understand, but there's also bright sparks. Like, universal basic income is not some moral play. It's actually about a whole new emancipation of humanity. It's about a completely different vision about how you unlock the power of every individual in a way that every individual and every actor in a way that we've never seen before. So there are also dreams and whispers of a whole new world that are being tried out already, that are being thought through. So I hear it, but I think there's big plays in play. And let's not also get locked into, you know, 5-10 years worth of conversations. Let's go back even 1947 in the UK, and I said this recently. 1947, UK turned around and basically said all development rights, every development right, you may own the land, but you don't own the right to develop. That is owned by the state collectively, us, all of us. So big things have been possible, have been achieved. So let's not forget our capacity for grand transformations of ourselves, to see a different worldview, to organize ourselves in a different way. So I hear it, but I also think there's a whole other movement coming which will be bigger and stronger in some aspect.
I want to pick up on something you said around the oscillation between the individual and the whole.
Yeah.
And from perhaps one of our biggest blind spots is our tendency to look to individual heroes and innovators rather than communities and ecosystems to address some of these future challenges. Why do we, like, we know it. Why do we do this? Why do we keep doing this? And how can we close this blind spot?
I think we do it because I think that's how we see the world right now. But I would theoretically argue that many of us that sit on a... I'll give you an example. I had the fortune of meeting a very senior CEO of an organization in Germany some time ago. I met him, and I thought, wow, what an amazing guy. Really, I was like, how does he see the world this way? I met him about a year later, right? And I was like, ooh, he'd lost his job, he'd moved on. He wasn't sitting in the place that he was sitting. He didn't have the flow of information that he had. And I thought, ooh, you're not seeing the world that interestingly anymore. And at that moment in time, I realized, actually, it wasn't about him. It was the place in the world he was sitting that was the confluence of information and power and ideas and thoughts. And I think once we start to see that, here's a thesis, right? Einstein came up with E equals MC squared. Maybe a few years later, somebody else would have done the same thing. I think many things are just a product of zeitgeist. They are a product of the context we sit in, right? And we are honored to take that place for a few moments to be the crystallization of that zeitgeist. It is not us. If you replaced me with someone else, it would have been someone else. And I think in that act, if we honor the zeitgeist, I think we're in a better place to be, because actually that's where we are. We take a temporary moment on stage to be able to crystallize it, but it's not us. It could have been anyone else. And I think that's just, it's just a different way of seeing the problem, right? It doesn't change anything, just a different way of seeing the issue. And I think that way alleviates this problem of the trap of the hero. The hero is as much trapped as the other people, right? He or she is also equally trapped by this narrative. So I think there's a kind of different way of acknowledging this.
Right, yeah. I was in the UAE recently.
Yeah.
And when I think about places that are intentionally catalyzing a future-oriented culture, Dubai, UAE, certainly comes to mind. They're crafting the narratives. They were systematically working together across governments and ministries. They're organizing themselves differently.
Yeah.
Democracies, Western democracies at least, can't seem to do this. They struggle with a culture of the future. They struggle to craft a future narrative. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because in democracies, the future narrative has to be about the kind of the emancipation and the freedom of everyone, and we've lost our ability to, and the social justice mechanisms to be able to talk about that properly, and we're locked into a kind of meritocracy illusion, which is actually bullshit. There is no such thing as meritocracy in real terms. Yeah, you know, however privileged you are, well, you're a product of your privilege, and that privilege is so many different ways. So the reality is we've been locked into intellectual mine holes, words like meritocracy, which are illusions and no longer sufficient for the context. So I was in I'll give you a perfect example. I was with a bunch of Oxford students, right? Oxford University students. And we were talking about universal basic income. And first question was, how many of you think is a good idea? 70% of them said, no, it's a bad idea. I said, why? Because people are gonna get lazy and not gonna do any work. I said, okay. How many of you have had grants and foundations to get here? About 50% of them put their hand up and said, so when did you fail your Oxford exams? Didn't fail them. Really, why? So you realize that we other all these things. We're no longer thinking. We don't believe that everyone has the capacity to be extraordinary. And I think once you have to believe that in your heart and soul, then we can create a kind of democracy which is actually fruitful, because it's about emancipation of everyone. Then we have an imagination. Then we can talk about a different future. Then we can talk about Star Trek. But we're currently locked. Because if the whole conversation is about dividing who gets a little bit of the value, we can, and that's the other issue. You know, you love this quote too, but Interstellar quote, right? Where basically we spend all our time arguing about who has which part of the cake or the dirt, rather than forgetting about the infinite possibility of the world that we sit in front of. Infinite possibility. And that's largely, I think, a construct, by the way. I think this is a construct that has been constructed for us. That is the language and the frame and the division that's been constructed, right? And so I'm, you know, in the UK, I would say there's no surprise, and I've written about this publicly, there is no surprise that in the UK, the division on race and other issues is coming to the fore because fundamentally it was a mechanism to divide the issue about structural inequality that was growing. It was a way to kill that conversation, the scale of this issue on structural inequality. It's become a classic instrument of doing that. And I think until you put emancipation and the freedom and the empowerment of everyone on the table, we cannot talk about a future because we're locked from that discourse.
Indeed, thank you so much. Absolutely wonderful. We're going to just move to Slido and bring up a couple of questions. Just move over. And I'm going to invite Nick and Jess to come up as well. Do we have some juicy questions? On
Oh, boy.
Okay. Jess, I'm going to start with you. But everyone, sort of feel free to jump in. This is super good. If history is revised by each generation in power, is there any such thing as objective truth or fact in this narrative?
I think it requires a redefinition of truth, and that there's multiple truths that can exist in the world. And to Indy's point, what truths lead us to an emancipation of everyone? I really appreciated that. And so I think that we need a reframe on how we define truth. So.
Great. Nick, a reframe?
A reframe. Is the question still about objective truth? I think the idea of objective truth.
You want to break the question?
Yeah, a little bit. I loved what Indy said about the conventions of language kind of not really being up to the tasks that we need right now and us needing to stretch what language is able to do because, you know, using language to describe the world is so often like eating soup with a fork. So when it comes to truth, I think truth is kind of created across a procedure. The philosopher Alain Badiou has talked about truth procedures and that, like, chance events happen, people commit to be fidelitous to these events, that they're going to keep this in mind and move forward in a way that, like, keeps it. So when we talk about legacy, like, moving forward and saying, yeah, actually, this is somebody we're going to hold up and deify as, like, an example, and then we kind of move forward. But as far as objective truth is, like, objective meaning there are no subjects involved, I don't think that kind of truth really exists. And, yeah.
Oh, okay. Very interesting. Indy, your take.
I think the truth that I'm interested in is the truth that assigns from our best consciousness of the moment. And I think when we start to recognize that the best consciousness of the moment deals with some of the atrocities that we've done, that is the truth of the moment. And when we go 100 years from now, we may realize that we were committing other atrocities. And we may become conscious of another possibility, and that truth will be viably and correctly reframed, and we will move forward. And I think that is where we have to give ourselves the freedom, but it's the birth of the kind of the best way of seeing the world that we can bring to bear at that moment in time. And I think we have to give ourselves the latitude to be able to openly revise and recognize as our awareness changes, so our notion of what the truth was changes, and we evolve. And it's not without harm, but it's about recognition.
Terrific. Give ourselves the permission to openly revise. This is another juicy question. Liberation and emancipation. What does it mean to advance this as part of our work?
Yeah.
What does this look like in the field every day?
I think this is a full stack question. So what I mean by that...
What question?
A full stack. You've got to deal with this problem as a full stack. One, I think it's stuff like about... So there's a really brilliant book called About Wounded Leadership. which is about effectively the wounds that happened to us previously, and we actually end up replicating the same behaviors. So this is actually a big break in us as individuals and what wounds we've brought forward and bring their next generation. Second, it's about actually language. Third, it's about actually how do you embody care in every situation. In order to deal with this transition, we have to actually talk about embodying care. Everyone has to care. How do you create the conditions for everyone to care? Because unless you can create the conditions for everyone to care, you cannot deal with emancipation. That emancipation without care is violence. So we have to create the conditions, embodied human conditions to care. Then we can talk about creativity, and then we can talk about the freedom to redefine what it means to be us. But I think it's a full stack, and I think this is a journey that we're on, and perhaps is a kind of long journey of transformation. But these journeys have historically happened, right? So Enlightenment period, we went through a journey of discovering what it meant to be human, and we wrote the history of what it meant to be human at that period of time. Earth civilization did that. I think we're now on our next journey, and I think science is also adopting us and assisting us to be able to see and reconcile histories that we weren't able to reconcile. And that reconciliation is allowing us to move forward, but it has a fundamental different economic and structural and social architecture. And we have to, and language and culture. And I think that is the big transformation that we're on. But we have done this before as a human species. Let's not break it. It is possible. It's doable. We've done it, and we can do it.
Right. Terrific. Last question to you, Nick. I like the idea of the long-term approach, but wouldn't a 10,000-year horizon delay action?
So again, to the point that we were talking about a little bit earlier, if I asked you to solve world hunger in 5 years, I think that delays action because it paralyzes, because it's not something you can do. You know you're overdetermined.
Interesting.
Whereas giving you a longer time horizon allows you to get started. So I actually think it actually incites action. I think it means like, okay, cool, I don't have to finish this project. I don't have to reach the goal in just my lifetime. I can pass that torch. I can find good ways to pass the torch to the next generation and keep this project a multi-generational project and keep the goal point out at a distance. Because some of these things we just can't do super quickly. And those projects get left behind when you don't have a long time horizon.
Right. Quick reactions, Jess, Indy, to that?
I'm caught up in this idea of language. I'm listening to you speaking, and I'm listening, and I'm just thinking about... how we're creating a monoculture of the English language globally, and that's really dangerous. And so for me, I'm just curious about, can we all just learn more languages? And in particular, I think about the indigenous languages that still have a possibility of being learned here. And in Anishinaabemowin, which would be the language that I would speak, had it not been forcibly removed from generations of Anishinaabe people, we don't use nouns. We talk about things in relationship to the qualities of what that is and our relationship to it, whether it's physical or geographic and that sort of thing. And so the worldviews that you're talking about, I'm so worried that we're moving ourselves towards only seeing the world with one worldview through the English language. That's my last thought.
It sounds like we've got some more time. So, let's dive into this, because this is something that we picked up on. English is a monoculture, a global language. The risks of that for current and future generations. Indeed, this was a language of the industrial world in many ways, and as we move from an industrial world to a, as you would say, a systems world, a post-industrial world. What do you see? What's the role of English? What's the role of language?
I think there's a lot to learn from indigenous languages, actually. I think they construct, as you said, it's not a noun-based system. And I think they construct a completely different syntax and a way of seeing the world. And I think I genuinely believe, so people, very interesting, people like Thomas Born, a quantum physicist and a philosopher, was writing about our need to reimagine language as a really, in the 1970s, right? And there's beautiful videos of him talking about this. And I think this is now a kind of collective consciousness and there is emergence of a different discourse. So I think we will remake this. And I think even how we, and the big issue is also how we're constructing our code, and our code and our infrastructure, our language and our technology, which is also actually an object-oriented language. So how do we start to reframe how we think about code languages to live in a relational world? And I think there's something going on, and we're at the beginning of the story. So, but I suppose I want to just bring that sort of idea that we can evolve. And I want to, we can evolve as a civilization, we can evolve as humanity, and I think we can do this. And I think there's a lot to learn, as you rightly say, about different language structures and syntax. And that's been well thought through, and people have been thinking about it since the 70s. I just think the issue is we haven't brought it to bear in the 21st century and started to really embrace it as not just a nice to, but actually as the foundation of a movement, a foundation of the revolution that we would talk about.
Right. Nick, Long now is based in San Francisco, heart of Silicon Valley and global technology scene in many ways. English is the language there, and there's a lot of code coming out of San Francisco and the Bay Area. So as you look out to the 10,000-year horizon, how do you bring indigenous languages, and if code is one of the languages of the future, how do we bring that into how do we bring that into our world?
Yeah, I think the languages that we're bringing into our world kind of are going to come in naturally. When I see like meme culture online and the way that people kind of communicate with images and GIFs in a way that I didn't grow up communicating, but it actually gets at something that's kind of between the words, it's kind of between the fork times. It's kind of really interesting to see us use symbolic systems to describe things that we haven't before. So I think these kinds of languages, maybe we don't recognize them as languages now, but we're using a structured, symbolic mediation between people to get at something really real. And that's awesome, and that's really cool. When it comes to indigenous languages and like pulling things from the past into the future and keeping them, again, this is the what we're doing with the Rosetta Project. And Dr. Laura Welcher, the director of that project, she's one of the last, she's one of the last living speakers of Potawatomi. And Potawatomi has interesting things that I can't really speak like on a stage about, but she's told me some things about just what this worldview is structured like because of the way they structure their verbs. I guess there's like an agential thing. You can modify how much agency something has, which is, so you could walk like a parish parson or you could walk like a rock, right? Like you could kind of like, so it's really, really interesting. It's fascinating. And she's, you know, she's been working with the National Science Foundation to preserve Potawatomi with dictionaries, grammars, Swadesh lists, parallel text translations of the United Declaration of Human Rights.
What would happen if you were to fuse what she's been doing with code, right? Let's do some radical fusion. So if you take that worldview or take an indigenous language, right, from Canada here, and you get and start to reinvent a code language in that worldview, what would happen? How would we construct the world in this new technological infrastructure and that worldview? I think these sort of experiments we just need to get liquid around and start to play out this stuff. Sorry.
Example of that, I think, and there's an organization called ThinkLife out of the United States, and they've been working with indigenous elders to create a value system for a new Bitcoin. And so Bitcoin was, anyway, I'm trying to understand Bitcoin first and foremost, and so this really fascinates me, though.
I think there's a brain date on.
Yeah. Is there? Oh, maybe I should go to that one. But yeah, so there's like this idea of what would it be to be able to infuse perhaps indigenous language into something like a blockchain program. Yeah.
Or even the fundamentals of code. I would love to see what would coding language look like if you took that worldview. How would you imagine it? Because I think there's something potentially really powerful in that sort of, and these sort of experiments are going to be really important to be able to, I think, change our worldview, but thereby change the instruments that we make our world with. That's the other thing. It's not just about the language, but it's changing the instruments. And code is one of the most powerful instruments that we're constructing our world with. And so I think being able to do that, will open up whole new horizons.
And the first step in that, I think, is really investing, like in Canada, really investing in indigenous language for everyone.
Right. I've got one last question, and then we're going to, I don't know what we're going to do. I do. We're going into brain dates. So I want to bring this back to the Sustainable Development Goals a little bit. If we're serious about making a big dent in the SDGs, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and we spoke about this morning as well, is we have to figure out how we balance and Indy, you spoke about this, the future possibility view with the redistribution of the now view. Balancing these two is going to be hard. It's not easy. There's a reason why it's not part of our. I'm curious, what's the risk to current and future generations if we merely focus on the redistribution of the now without also focusing on the possibilities of tomorrow? Indy?
Well, I think the redistribution of the now narrative is not even viable. So if you look at the scale of conflict and nationalism that we're seeing rising around the world, we will seed a world of conflict. And I think we're starting to seed that landscape. And I think what we have to do is talk about the infinite capacity of the possible, and then talk about how we actually build the capacity for everyone to engage that possible. And I think this is politics, in my view. This is that's a political strategy for transformation without causing massive conflict. And I think in that story, I think we have to we have to accept there is a huge possibility on that. But also we have to remember, right, I think we're about 50 to 60 years from pretty much planet genocide. If we carry on going the way we are, we're dead on our feet. So actually there isn't
that. Is it only 50?
we're on a pretty serious curve, and there's really no stopping it right this moment in time. And so if you look at some of this stuff, I think we have to put that risk on the table and then start to actually talk about this transformation. Because I think, you know, this is not about two people escaping to Mars. It doesn't work.
Right.
I think some of those prognostications, though, like the world's over in 60 years, I think this is part of where that's the core of our mission, is if we plan like we're going to be out of here in a couple of generations, we're going to do things way differently than if we actually think, all right, let's actually plan as if we're going to be here for 10,000 years. As ridiculous and improbable as it sounds, I mean, it's very improbable that we're all here. I consider it very improbable that I'm here talking to all of you. I don't think it's a sure thing that we're going to be around in 10,000 years, but if we plan like we're going to be done in 60, like, it might be a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Possibly. I mean, it all depends on what you say. I would say the 10,000-year horizon is about, for me, is about the emancipation with careful freedom. So when I look up at the stars, it makes me feel like I'm insignificant, and that's really useful because it actually deparalyzes me. But what it needs is for me to be careful in that insignificance to be able to actually react. So for me, the 10,000 years is not about the non-action. 10,000 years, as I read it, and I love it, by the way, the Long Now Foundation, I see it as a freedom, but a careful freedom. So it's a way to act and gracefully into that time cycle, which I think you're right. I only bring about that 10,000 years, there are certain forces, 60 years, there's certain forces in play that's put us in a pretty bad trajectory. Maybe not for all of us, but certainly large groups of we're already seeing the effects. So the things that we just need to do. But I understand exactly the mentality you're saying.
Jess?
I like listening to you guys talk. to me, the word that stands out to me is care, and how can we actually care and show that we care, and then how can we be careful in the steps that we're taking now. And I believe that there's like small little micro gestures that help us to move and to think into future thinking too. So to be able to identify those things. Just one example I know we're running out of time, but just one example. I have a friend whose name is Asad Chisti, and he's been working on a project for 10 years. He's only in a couple of years of it now, but he wants to live for 10 years exploring what it means to be living a good life. And he's committed to this 10-year process. And he, along the way, he'll begin to reprogram the way that he lives in the world because of the things that he's learning. But he first has to commit that far and to hold on to that.
Wow. Jess, Nick, Indy, thank you so much. You've given so much for us to think on. We've talked about so much here. Emancipation, universal emancipation. We talked about wealth and and legacy. We talked about indigenous languages and how we bring that outlook and worldview into coding. We've talked about is the short and the long term. What's more paralyzing for us, right? How we bring that in. We've also talked about care and what does it look like to bring care into everything we do. This is going to beautifully set us up for our conversations this morning and this afternoon. So thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you.